premio 2000 a Kathy Prendergast.
The announcement for the Best Young Artist Year 2000 Prize.
Per la raffinata, sottile, modulata semplicità delle sue scritture dense di poesia.
I'd like to thank all the Irish team for all their help and support, and a special thanks to Vittorio Urbani for allowing us to show our work in his beautiful gallery, Nuova Icona, and for all his warmth and hospitality while we've been here. Thank you. Ritira il premio Kathy Prendergast.
Kathy, it's been a fantastic day for you, and I know we're going to have a longer conversation in less hectic circumstances, but you've won this prize here in Venice. What are you thinking about at the moment?
Well, I'm absolutely delighted. It's been a great surprise, and it's been a great rounding off to a fantastic week that we've had here, putting up the work and looking at all the other stuff in the Biennale.
But the work, as I said to you the other night before all this happened, impressed me. I mean, it has a quiet authority that somehow or other made an intervention in a situation that's like an international art stage. It's a carnival here, huge amounts of money being spent on presenting art and so on, but the work you've made is a series of drawings and small pieces that has somehow made such a huge impression. As somebody mentioned tonight, it's like a whisper, but it's had this incredible resonance in Venice that has been recognised by you winning this major prize.
I wonder if it's unusual that work is, say, small in its size in such a big exhibition like this. Like, I'd imagine normally people would go for very impressive pieces, but I think because we were also showing in a space that demanded work that wasn't large, it automatically suited me. For about the last two or three years, I have been concentrating on making work that's small. And I think that was just a shift for myself, that the work needed to be small. So, you know, this has given me a good reason to continue at that scale. But there's nothing else of that scale in this exhibition, which I think is one of the reasons why it stands out, funnily enough. I've actually always had a real problem of knowing what the inherent scale of a work should be. And, you know, if I say what that was, is one of the things that I've been trying to find for ages. So it seems like this somehow has gelled together in the process that I'm working on at the moment. So, you know, it's been very good to put the work up and realise that things are actually working and gelling. And I think that's one of the good things of being in a show like this, that you can stand back and see your work in relation to other artists and what else is going on at the moment.
Kathy, we're leaving Venice now for a while, and back in London, do you have a perspective now on that whole event?
It was extraordinary, and we left Venice on a complete high after, you know, working for the first week and putting up the work, and then all that happening was absolutely brilliant. Back here, on one level, everything's exactly the same. You know, you're just getting on with things. But on another level, there's a lot more interest in the work than, you know, had I not won that prize. And it's sort of been a lesson, in a way, for me to realise that the work is always the same. It's just how people see it as differently is different, that you know, the standard of the work existed before we went to Venice, and it's the same now. It's no better and no worse. But somehow a lot more people know about it, and I think people going to the Giudecca, almost like their minds have been made up for them before they see it. And I don't know if that sounds a bit sceptical, but I don't mean it to be. although our space was off the beaten track, I think we had the best space in the whole Biennale. We had the best gallery in Venice, and I think both myself and Shane really benefited from that. We didn't have any problems that couldn't have been got around. The curator Siobhan Barry went over at Christmas and spent, you know, I don't know how long, actually looking for a space, because all the countries that were in some other big place, everyone had to fend for themselves. So in a way, by everyone having to do that, maybe subconsciously Ireland, you know, picked something that was very separate. But, you know, I thought it was more because it was the best space Siobhan could get. And I don't know at that stage if they knew who the artists were. But I know I've always had a problem with big spaces in showing work. And when I found out that this was a very small, intimate sort of space, sort of domestic size rooms, I was delighted.
So if we can now return to your exhibition at Nova Icona, a gallery on the Giudecca. If we could start by you describing the three series of works that you showed there.
Yeah, the first work you see of mine when you come into the gallery are the map drawings, of which there's 49, which fill up the four walls of the room. They're placed one against another with a small gap in between. They don't really have frames on them. They have a piece of perspex on the front and on the back cut to the same size as the drawing. So I see them almost as unframed but protected. And because the room is so white, the only thing you're meant to see are the drawings, which run in a line just below eye level. They're very small, smaller than a person's head, probably half that size. And they're drawn quite intricately in pencil. I can't see the drawings as single things. They're more about looking at them as a group. And how many there is depends on how many are done at the time they're shown. They're not just about maps or cities in a way. I want them to look like something that you want to go closer to understand what they are. And I think when you start looking at one, it makes you want to go and look at the next one and the next one. One of the other pieces in the exhibition, which was shown alongside the third piece, is 200 Words for Lonely. And it's an offshoot of a project I'm just starting, which is researching all the place names in the world that have lonely in them, because there's an awful lot of lonely islands and things like that in gazetteers. And in a way, I wanted something global and circular, quite like the map drawing project, where the beginning and end are the same thing. And I started to research language and just picked the word lonely because of this other project. These words are written in lines in blue ink on a half-size pillow, half size of a normal pillow, and the blue lines are meant to sort of mimic the classic blue and white stripe of that ticking which is used for mattresses or pillows. And the third piece, which is almost a companion piece to that, is an untitled piece of which is a small knitted jumper in a natural colour. It's not a baby's jumper, it's a doll's jumper, and inside this jumper there's a simulated heartbeat or breathing, which is almost meant to be like an affirmation of some existence of, I don't know, life or whatever, which possibly is what the map drawings are as well. That piece was made over a long period of time where the jumper was knitted in the late 80s, and was just something that was knocking around in the studio, along with lots of other things that are made or half made or knocking around the studio. And the only thing I could think of doing with it was putting the motor in. The motor is quite noisy, which I thought was a problem in the beginning with the piece, because you can hear this sort of grinding and whirring. But in fact, now I realise that that's probably quite an important bit to the piece, that there is this, the noise is almost louder than what the movement suggests the movement is.
Can we go back to the drawings? There are apparently 180 in the series, and the catalogue speaks of this being an unfinished series, the numbers that were produced or that were presented in Venice. So this is a series that you will continue to make.
It is. At my last count, there should be 184 capital cities, and you know that might change by the time I've finished. But the reason I'm doing capitals is because it's something about an identity or a national identity. It's not a political statement, but it's almost like it'll always be unfinished, because that notion of what is a capital is never really fully defined. You know, whatever happens in the world, that could change. It's almost like a reworking of the roots of the city. It's almost like remaking the journey. Like, I think there's an automatic sort of supposition that a city is alienating, that it's difficult to get around, and that when you see a drawing that's soft, that's small, and that doesn't have those qualities to it, possibly it makes you think again of what it is. I think, you know, when we think of cities, we think of pollution, traffic, difficulties in negotiating transport and all that. And it's like if you take them away, if you get rid of all those things, you're just left with a structure, really. So having said that, at the same time, drawing places like London and Tehran and places like that, they are so dense that because I'm drawing them on such a small scale, although I've drawn in all the roads, just the thickness of the pencil blocks out something you've drawn before, so it ends up being very dense and muddy looking. So although everything that exists is drawn there, not everything exists anymore, because you've had to draw over what was there already. And it's at points like that they become interesting for me, when those sort of things start happening.
Where the process of drawing starts to inscribe its own presence.
Yeah, where it starts to do that on the actual drawing, but it is also saying something about the city, because it has a density and an overworking, which is very much like what London is like anyway. You know, buildings pulled down, put up, and it's just like layers of stuff being built one over the other.
Now, back to the celebration and press gathering at a restaurant in Venice. Kieran Benson, you're chairman of the Irish Arts Council. This has been a fantastic event and fantastic news about Cathy winning this prize. What's your initial reaction to the whole thing?
Well, I'm absolutely delighted on a number of grounds. I'm delighted for Cathy, and I also am delighted for the team that put it together, because they made very definite decisions. They made a decision to work with the Venetian. They made a decision to work on the margins. They chose work which isn't easily accessible, and they chose work which is actually very personal. And I think, given the curatorial job that Jean-Claire has done in his Identity and Alterity exhibition, Cathy's work fits in extremely well. And I find it interesting then that her work, and indeed Shane Cullen, who worked who is the second person, are part, as it were, of a zeitgeist. And that is interesting to us because we live on the margins of Europe. Well, I think if you look at the work, it's people would have to see it. It's meticulous drawings of cities, but almost at a distance so that it's fading. And the cities are repeated. So there's a concept of the city which he's working through. And the whole city, the city is instantiated right from Europe through Africa. There's actually almost a smudge to them. So they're a bit like a satellite photo of where most of us live. And yet they're fading. They're precise but fading.
I think one of the sort of significant things is the way in which this has made an intervention into this major art event. And that must have ramifications both for, I think, Venice Biennale, but also for Irish art.
Oh, absolutely. And I would like to point out that Cathy didn't arrive here alone. She arrived with another choice, Shane Cullen, whose work is also very interesting and curiously text-based, very personal, but also with a team, actually, of visual artists like Cecily Brennan around her, Siobhan Barry and Tanya Kiang and Peter Murray. So there's a generation, and this is one of the nice things about being chairman of the Irish Arts Council at the moment, there's a whole generation that's coming up that has a particular set of values, which are actually common. We all tend to share them. And it makes it's very gratifying for us to realise that this can be recognised. But the real significance is for us that Ireland has developed a self-confidence in the last 15 to 20 years, and particularly so in the arts. And it's great to see the visual arts now coming on stream, because music has done it. Our film is doing very well. Theatre has done well. And many of us, and my love is the visual arts, have wished that the visual arts could find this voice outside. And it's great to see Cathy being the cutting edge of this. I asked Jean Clare yesterday what he meant by alterity, because with my own background in psychology, I was interested in the idea of identity and alterity. And alterity in this context is being heard by others. So it's terribly important for Ireland to be heard by others. Not so much for the others to hear us, but for us to be heard. And this is a very good instance of it. So I'm delighted that it fits in so well to Jean Clare's idea of what the 1995 Biennale ought to be.
My name is Vittorio Urbani. I am an Italian. I am a medicine doctor originally, but I had the idea 2 years ago to use a part of my house in Venice to have an art gallery to show young artists mainly.
Victoria, your gallery has included this exhibition of Irish artists here at the Biennale.
We had this great opportunity to have the Irish official participation to the Biennale, and I love to remember that is the first time in 100 years of the Biennale that a private gallery in Venice is allowed to host an official show for the Biennale.
It's been incredibly successful, as you know, because Cathy Prendergast has now won a major prize at the Biennale. What do you feel about her work? I mean, did you see the work before you agreed to make this exhibition with the Irish artists?
In fact, last winter I visited her studio in London, and so our first contact was the less informal you can imagine, just seeing this plain work, very simple, in a very simple place where she works in London. And step after step, I become more and more fond of, perhaps more intrigued in her work. That is quite strangely, I think, for Case, rightly involved in the general theme of the Biennale, you know, that is identity and representation of the face of the man. In fact, her work, as you know, gives a sort of identity to the towns itself.
Peter, we've just congratulated Cathy Prendergast on winning this prize in Venice, and I wondered if you could say what you feel at this point, being the commissioner.
I'm absolutely over the moon. I think it's a wonderful achievement on Cathy's part, and it does acknowledge the quality of her work, which has been recognised in Ireland, and in London, because she's been given very good coverage in Ireland and exhibited at the Douglas Hyde, and the Arts Council in Great Britain have bought a piece of hers, a tent piece, which they've toured, and it's an important piece. And so her recognition there has not been neglected, but it certainly has been internationally. And I think it shows that the vitality in Irish art is one which is increasingly being recognised abroad. But it's, interestingly, in the context of British-Irish relations at the moment, it's a vitality which is almost inextricably linked to Britain, for, you know, better or for worse. She's an Irish artist, she's living in London, and she has an identity now that covers both cities, Dublin and London. And I think that it's a meshing of those identities. And the quality of the work that she has presented here in Venice is, I think, the poignancy, the emotion conveyed through the work, or the sense of feeling conveyed through the work, which is very strong, I think has been heightened by her transfer from her native city Dublin over to London. I think, you know, the sense of loneliness and the sense of isolation that is such a strong resonance in her work here in Venice is perhaps part of that wider identity of Irish people who have had to emigrate abroad, as so many have over the generations. So in a sense, you know, she is everything that Ireland represents, both at representing a local identity but also a much wider identity. I'm speaking as commissioner for the Irish entry, but even objectively, having gone around the other pavilion, I'm astonished at the amounts of money which have obviously been lavished by countries around the world in presenting their best, in inverted commas, artists, or their most important, in inverted commas, artists, sometimes succeeding, but more often not, I think, you know, not achieving that level of immediacy, of impact, where the viewer looks at something and is forced to reconsider their whole relationship with the world, which I think Cathy's work does achieve. It achieves it by being a whisper rather than a shout. And Venice is a city of the Carnevale, and so it's astonishing. I think it shows extremely good judgment on the part of the jury that they have not been, in a sense, seduced by some of the extraordinarily flamboyant and lavish presentations, and have made their way to the Nuova Icona Gallery on the Giudecca, which is down a little alleyway, 20 yards down the alleyway, just a little doorway in on the left-hand side, in the small, intimate gallery.
So, Shane Cullen, we're now in a little cafe round the corner from the gallery that the Irish representatives here in Venice are presenting work, and you have a piece that actually covers a whole wall as you walk through the gallery. It comprises 24 panels, essentially, of text. The background is black. The text is reversed out. It's white. The text derives from, I believe, messages sent out of Blanquesh by hunger strikers, and you've reconstituted the text, formalized it, hand-painted it, and the texts read as an account of the experiences of the hunger strikers. But perhaps you could go on from there and talk about why you've chosen those texts and why you've actually chosen to re-represent them in the way you have.
The texts that I'm using originally appeared in the format of handwritten documents that were written on cigarette papers that were sometimes single cigarette papers are joined together, tiny writing. I'm dealing with the specific texts that relate to the second hunger strike, the 1981 hunger strike, in which 10 Irish Republican prisoners starved themselves to death because they disagreed with the drive to criminalize their position, which was a political position, and they wished to be regarded as political prisoners rather than as criminals. The policy of criminalization of political prisoners was one that they resisted. To speak about the texts, the intimacy of the texts, the fact that they were written on cigarette papers, wrapped in cling film, and hidden in different parts of the body. And now what I've done is transform them into a very high rhetorical form. The tradition of political rhetoric, European Republican rhetoric, the public exposure of information access to information. All of these things are important to the work.
How do you want the sense of distance to be read from the original source of this information and the aspirations being expressed on, as you say, handwritten notes sent out on cigarette papers in the way they were, and the way in which you've reappropriated those messages by making them formal and quite monumental?
The distancing from the material is extremely important to me, because I think to engage with it on some kind of emotional level rather than a documentative, objective level would be not the correct strategy to approach this material with. The distancing in terms of ordering and the presentation of the information without any emotional context is extremely important. That's precisely the tradition that I think this work is in. Historical political works exist within European visual art culture from the period. One of the periods that I find most interesting is the period of the French Revolution, and artists like Jacques-Louis David, whose work was highly rhetorical but cold. They spoke about Jacques-Louis David's work as having, you could feel the cold, the breath of history coming through the works, the cold breath of history. There's a poeticism to it as well. I can't deny that. So what appears to be intellectual and dispassionate, actually its genesis is in emotional trauma and turmoil, you know? So the time period maybe is part of that.
You've actually, I was reading in the catalogue, chosen to physically paint this wall of text, which I find quite interesting, because it must have been incredibly laborious and demanding, and it could have been achieved very quickly by you actually doing it photographically. But I wondered if you could talk about this need to physically realise it.
Well, the need to physically realise it is my methodology of approaching this material. But the actual hand painting of the text is important, because the reading of the text and the making of the text, the time required to do this, is a time that is my time. And maybe it actually parallels a situation where a person is incarcerated and imprisoned and has to somehow realize some ideas about freedom or some rite of passage.
I just feel, though, that the formality of presentation provides the work with quite a strange tension, knowing where the origins of the material and the source of the material have come from. There's that tension, and as I was saying, the tension of now and then, and the remapping of ideas and emotions that were taking place 10 years ago onto the present, and how those are read now, particularly in relation to recent Irish history and the IRA ceasefire.
This work was started before the ceasefire. In a sense, I've chosen a fixed point in history, and everything else is changing around this fixed point. But I think artists necessarily do that anyway. They choose fixed points. They present their works, and everything else is in flux. The authenticity of this work does not lie in a European context. Its authenticity lies within an Irish context, and it's particular to Ireland. And I think that even though you move this work into a European context, the authenticity of it is within the Irish context, and that authenticity is something that can be moved into a European context.
One thing occurred to me while at the beginning of your conversation with remembering his text and Douglas Gordon's piece on hysteria, And when you were talking about the need to distance, not only personally, but there has been a tendency to report Ireland, if you like an hysteric woman. You know, it's very easy to deal with the whole situation, not with the issues, but with it as an emotional outburst. So it seems to me, historically, it's even more important, rather than merely personally, to make it distanced like that, to make you, forces you not to think of how it was written, the conditions in which it was written, but what has been written, the content. And you read it dispassionately and you realize that this person's talking about dying. And I think that the impact is all the stronger. But it just occurred to me that, you know, there's a very similar treatment of issues from Ireland, in British press in particular, as there is to the treatment in the 19th century of women.
That's very interesting. But that, I mean, like the Republican tradition in Ireland is very old. It dates back to 1798. And the jewel of Irish history is that its genesis is in the Ulster Unionist Loyalist tradition. And how that has transferred itself into the Catholic nationalist traditions and socialist tradition is an extraordinary event within history and gives an incredible dynamic possibility to the future of visual culture, all culture in Ireland. You know, I'm extremely hopeful, and in the light of the recent ceasefire, I'm extremely hopeful about a dynamic being preserved and emerging within the whole kind of cultural arena within Ireland, to preserve difference within social, political, geographical context is extremely important, especially when you think that Ireland is an island. It is an island of the west coast, of the extreme west coast of Europe, and for difference to disappear from the Ireland would be disastrous. To preserve difference is extremely important, and to provide a framework, a dynamic, imaginative framework for that is it's a challenge. It's a challenge to political imagination. It's a challenge to imaginations of artists. It's a challenge to the imaginations of writers. It's a golden opportunity, really.
Sounds from an installation by Gilles Barbier called Pages, Roses at Scuola del Arsenale.
Jean Fisher, can we start by talking about the Biennale? Have you formed any overview? I mean, do you have any sense of it as an event in terms of a particular character?
This is the first Venice Biennale I have ever been to, so I have no historical points with which to make a comparison. However, my impression of what I've seen so far is one of extreme conservatism. I imagine the Biennale should be something that very much is a sort of showcase for young, interesting, experimental, vital art. But what this Biennale seems to have concentrated on is a lot of somewhat regressive, conservative, and not to mention old artists. As for the younger artists that I've chosen, I want to say that as editor of the journal called Third Text, I don't wish to be a spokesperson for non-European artists, but there are many non-European artists who contacted me prior to my coming here, and it's the first time that Third Text has come here, who said, again, yet again, not one single black artist was chosen for this Venice event. It's as if they don't know that those artists exist in Britain.
Iponsi, what do you think of the Biennale?
Well, I think that I agree with Jean 100%. The only experience that I have got about Biennales is in Cuba. So, you know, I just can say that maybe Cuba have got a more challenged Biennale than this Biennale. But I can't really say so many things because, like Jean, I don't know the history very much about this Biennale. But maybe we could talk about more specific. It's more easier for me to talk, you know, about this Biennale because it's difficult for me to say things in a general point of view because my only perception about this Biennale is what I am seeing for the first time now.
One of the characters of Venice Biennale is the idea of a set of pavilions which are very mm-hmm. innately related to countries and mm-hmm. national identities. Mm-hmm. They almost appear to be embassies. Mm-hmm. And this was the way in which the event was described to me a number of years ago, that you swim from one embassy to another. There was an attempt in the last Biennale to try and somehow or other dissolve those kind of nationalist concepts in terms of pavilions, but you're an artist from Cuba. I wondered how you saw that dimension of this Biennale.
I actually think that there is a very perverse way to analyze culture in this particular way, because I think that art have a very strong sophistication that people doesn't seem to see out of country, out of reality, but you know with a new kind of reality that put together important elements and important thought that in the end of the day are the thing that make people understand about what we are dealing in this modern society. So I don't really understand about it.
Right, I agree with Afonso that bracket art under a nationalistic framework is a complete perversion of what should be a practice that transcends such narrowly defined notions. Art should be about expanding beyond such artificial boundaries, not to be confined within them. This is why actually both of us found one of the most interesting pavilions to be the Canadian. Right. And you know, the curator in the Canadian, whose name is Gerald McMaster, we were standing in the pavilion talking about the artist's work. The artist's name is Edward Poitras. And he said a very interesting thing. He said, look at this piece, and he was referring to the piece with Coyote and the Gold Wall. And he said, look how, in the European tradition, the work stops at the surface. But how, for us, native Canadians, it is behind, it is up, it is around, it is in every dimension. And he said something there that just struck a chord about the whole notion of like framing art. Yeah.
We are actually going back to this traditional quotation to put people in box and try to discover something inside the box, but not the extension of the box as an important part to understand the nature of the, you know, of the reality.
Now, Milena Kalinowska, you've heard what we've been talking about in relation to the Biennale and the idea of pavilions being, in a sense, a focus of a national identity. But I wondered if you could give a view. And I should say before you do, it's nice to meet you here because we know you from Riverside Studios, where you left, I think, in 1986. But it's, as I say, it's very good to meet you again. What do you think of the Biennale?
Well, we are definitely missing Aperta because most of the curators would be looking forward to seeing new works, and I would be one of them. It's fascinating the way you talk about the pavilions, because though we had a number of discussions about how to escape nationalistic or national point of view, the pavilions indeed are there, and they have been there for 100 years. And to me, what is fascinating is you go from one to another, and you can almost tell what the different countries' turmoils might be and where they are successful and where they are less successful. I've been, for example, really surprised to see the Russian pavilion for 2 years being surprisingly non-bureaucratic in terms of what they presented. Last year they presented the work of Ilya Kabakov, and this year they have presented the work, I think it's collaboration between three artists. But you can tell by going to the pavilion and looking at the installation that the initiative must have really come from the artists rather than from large administrative body, which you really strongly experience in other pavilions, particularly French or indeed British. The German pavilion, to me, is always fascinating because I think they have, in a way, really faced their struggle with their identity and with their history by always attempting to look at it from different sort of sides. And though you may say that the work may be successful or may not be successful, you sense the struggle. And for me as a curator, I'm more interested in attempts resolving questions and the work which is leading you to certain kind of thinking than just have a pleasure of really seeing a really well-formulated work, which I can go and see in the museums.
So what are the agendas of this Biennale?
We really do look back into, according to the chief curator, identity and what is formed, what forms that identity. However, I have not seen as yet the historical exhibition to which I really look forward to seeing in Palazzo Grazie. And I think that you do see attempts within the different exhibitions. However, you cannot ever force the artist to follow a particular agenda. Or it's even more difficult when you are working with panels or selectors to make them comply with a particular agenda.
But when you leave, what will be the most memorable experiences in relation to the artist's work here?
I probably will be remembering several artists that I have already been interested in or whose work has reinforced my... really information about the artists that I'm already fascinated or interested in. One is always hoping that one will come across something that one is not familiar with yet, and that hasn't happened, but I have been here only for one day, and it's not surprising.
You haven't seen the Bill Viola, have you, or the British Pavilion? Do you have any views on those particular exhibits?
I have in some way always, you know, again, in the United States, in the pavilions there, the exhibitions are being selected and presented to a particular group that is judging. What I'm always surprised by is a particular support that the particular artist receives to do the presentation, but to some extent it doesn't really reflect what is going on in the country, meaning in the United States. That kind of support doesn't happen for the artists there generally. And as you know, the NEA is collapsing, and there is an enormous attack on the arts, and it's considered elitist. And so there is this, like, two sections. On the one hand, you have United States presented with a very ambitious work, with enormous amount of support. And on the other hand, what we have in the United States, it's nothing that the American pavilion really sort of reflects. In the British pavilion, I think you have a different situation. Again, it's selected, I believe, by the committee. And, you know, indeed, the artist that you could be looking at is a very good artist. But what you are not really sensing is a response to the questions or discussions of the time. And you never have the sense of real struggle on the part of the selectors of looking into the work, which would maybe talk to us in today's language or in today's, in up-to-date discussions that artists are engaged in, which is not to say that the artist is not good. I'm just saying that sometimes these selections may not be quite appropriate at the particular time.